This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Do you remember the movie Mean Girls? The screenplay to the 2004 film was written by SNL and 30 Rock star Tina Fey, who also had a role in the film. The movie was a worldwide hit and remains almost a cult classic 10 years later. But did you know it was based on a nonfiction book called Queen Bees and Wannabes? Now the author of that book has left the world of girls and is headed on over to the boys.
I really needed to work with boys to help them, just the way that I'd done with girls, to help them tell people what their worlds were like.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation with author Rosalind Wiseman about her book about boys' world, Masterminds and Wingmen. We'll also spend an academic minute looking for a little self-control, or a lot of self-control, or is that even a thing? I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When Rosalind Wiseman wrote the book Queen Bees and Wannabes, the last thing she thought about was it being turned into a movie, let alone one that made over $100 million worldwide. What she wrote was an on-the-money description of girl world and how navigating the social dynamics of that world is harder than, well, just about anything. That book was eventually made into the movie Mean Girls. Well, in her new book, she has taken on the world of boys. Rosalind Wiseman is an internationally recognized best-selling author and educator who has written books and articles about education, self-esteem, and bullying. She's a consultant to Cartoon Network's Speak Up, Stop Bullying campaign and has been profiled in the New York Times, People, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Washington Post, and USA Today. We spoke recently about her book, and I asked why an expert on girls' world has moved on over to boys' world.
Well, I've always worked with boys in equal numbers to girls. It's just that I'm not as well known for it because of Queen Bees. But it really occurred to me over a long period of time that I really needed to work with boys to help them tell people what their worlds were like. So what I did was I asked boys around the country to help me and collaborate with me on writing Masterminds and Wingmen. And so they did. For 2 years, we had boys between the ages of about 10 to 18 who helped me all the time, day in, day out. Sometimes I would catch them not doing their homework, or they would email me in the middle of the day, and I'd say, aren't you in class? And they really edited and gave me advice for every part of the book.
And where did you find these boys?
Well, I mean, that's the question, right? It's like, where did they come from?
Uh-huh.
How could I have found boys who would do this? I actually first started out working and asking, a lot of the schools that I had worked with around the country, because I really have amazing relationships with all different kinds of schools. But they said to me, you know, okay, we're going to give you one shot, right, to see if our boys want to do this. And so I went to a dozen schools around the country, and I met with the boys, and I said, this is what I'm doing, and if you want to help me, I would really like your help. And it's not going to be focus groups. It's really going to be you're going to have to read. You're going to have to edit. You're going to have to tell me when I'm doing it wrong, when I'm doing it right, you know, telling me all the things that adults need to know about what's going on in your world. And the only thing that I promised them is that I would do a college recommendation or a work recommendation for the high school students. And really across the board, we got very easily, I got these boys and young men to come forward and work with me every day. And then there were boys who would just contact me out of the blue who would say, I've heard that you're doing this. I'd like to get involved. And then the last thing is I would do assemblies. And after the assemblies, I would say to boys, hey, I'm doing this. Anybody want to help me? So from there, it just grew into this big group of kids who were constantly helping me.
You have two boys. When you went into this, did you know, well, I know where this is going to go?
No, actually, this is the book. It's funny. This book is the book I knew the least amount of what I would do. I really, when I started, I remember thinking, I don't have a clue where this is going to go, and can I do it? You know, I really I didn't know if I could get the boys to help me. So I really didn't know. And my own children, it's tough having a mom who does what I do for a living. It's annoying. And so they didn't really want to be a part of it. The only chapter that they read was the video game chapter. And then the other part is that as I was writing Masterminds, I was also writing a book for high school boys themselves. And so on the day that Masterminds was published, a free ebook came out for boys called The Guide that they could have in their phones that was really for them. So the boys and I wrote a book for parents and for people who care about boys, and then we wrote a book directly for the boys. So, you know, all the girls hate you in your class, go to page 75. You're about to get caught in a huge lie that your mom is just about to find out about, go to page 87. And the boys, or the editors, are telling and helping the boys, like, these are the problems that we think you're probably going to get into, and here are the ways in which to collectively where you think is the best way to deal with it. And so from there, it was really organic. I just kept writing and writing and writing. So it was incredibly fun. Difficult to write two books at the same time, but it was really fun to do.
We all have our stereotypes of what, you know, boys' world is. Is it misunderstood, especially compared to girls' world?
Oh, hugely, hugely. Then I get it. I understand why, you know, you look at boys and you think there's not a lot going on. And then you talk to them and you say, like, how is it going? What's going on? They say, it's fine. I'm good. Don't worry about it, right? I mean, they say, I'm good. My own children will say, I'm good, for all different kinds of responses to things. So I will say to them, like, I actually have no idea what you're saying when you say I'm good. I'm good, you don't like it. I'm good, you do like it. I'm good, you want to be left alone. Like, you got to clarify what the I'm good means. But I really do think that we are even more invested in our own stereotypes and our own assumptions about boys than we are about girls. And, you know, I would point out, like, there's one thing I think that's really stands out is that we constantly say, you know, boys are easy. They're simple. They don't hold grudges the way girls do. And if they get into a fight, then they just still punch, you know, they'll punch, you know, they'll fight physically and then it's over. But that's not at all what is going on with boys. And the other part is we say girls are really hard. And so I want us to think as parents and as educators what we do when we say that. So what we say about girls is, you know, girls are hard, is that we expect them to be nasty, mean, backstabbing people, which, you know, girls can have those experiences. It's one of the reasons I wrote Queen Bees, but it should not be the expectation, because girls need to trust other girls. They need to be able to have strong relationships with other girls so they can have strong relationships with women. And so it's really bad for girls, but it's also equally bad for boys, because when we say boys are easy, what we're saying is that we expect them to have everything roll off their back, right? It's, you know, everything from a very young age. And if boys have really deep, strong feelings about things, about being betrayed by a friend or having some horrible thing happen to them, and they can't roll it off their back, then what they're getting the message from us is there's something wrong with them. And then I want us to fast forward that, and for boys in high school, you know, boys in high school can see some pretty messed up stuff and not do anything about it. Well, they've had a lifetime of conditioning, of just let it roll off your back. And part of the problem is that we reinforce those messages.
Who are the masterminds? Who are the wingmen?
Well, the masterminds are the boys that are able to influence the other boys, from everything from, like, which shoes are cool shoes, to your music, to girls, to should you try hard in school. They organize, like, where the group goes. So they have a lot of influence, and the boys will just sort of go along with the mastermind. He has a lot of social power. The wingman actually was something that I put in there, not as an absolute balance or counterbalance to masterminds, but the wingman for me was this funny moment with the guys that I was working with. I want a wingman to be a term that boys use when they need support from somebody else, no matter what, right? Like, more tied to the traditional definition of it, like somebody going into battle with you and is going to be on your wing in really difficult times. And my guy editors and I, when we first started, really argued, well, they took them a while to actually tell me this, but they're like, well, that's not the way we use it. We only use it when we're trying to hit on a girl and we need our buddy to help us out. And so we did have these, like, really intense debates about the concept of wingmen. And I would like it to be that we would have discussions with boys about what a wingman really is, and that's somebody who's really loyal to you in ways that, you know, he says things that maybe you don't want to hear, right, that's hard to hear, that maybe you're acting in crazy ways, and he needs to stand up to you and say, hey, you're, like, completely off. Or wingman going in and supporting you in all different kinds of ways. If you've got a really difficult family situation, or, you know, you're not embarrassed to be able to say to tell him what's complicated in life and what's getting you down. So that's what I want for the boys, and that's the kinds of conversations that I want adults to be able to have with kids.
And it seems like you have different types of wingmen. The associate, the bouncer, the entertainer, that
thing. Oh, well, right. I mean, just like in Queen Bees, I find it helpful in some ways to be able to look at the patterns that people behave like in moments, especially when there are moments of, like, you know, when there's conflict or when there's an abuse of power. And so boys said to me, and I was pretty open to, like, well, maybe they don't have these kinds of roles. They're like, oh, we totally do. That in any group of boys, you would have a mastermind, then you have an associate who backs up the mastermind. You have a bouncer who's somebody who sort of takes the fall for the socially powerful boys because he thinks that's the way to show loyalty. You have an entertainer, somebody who, you know, is really verbal and funny, but also is good at being, if the mastermind does, or the bouncer, or somebody does something really horrible to another kid, especially in their group, the entertainer will, like, say something self-deprecating, put himself down, or say something that makes it sort of even and more comfortable for everybody. The punching bag is a guy in the group who, that within the group, the boys tease and humiliate a lot. But they also feel like nobody else can do that to them. So it's like that thing when we say, like, I can say whatever I want about my brother or my sister, but nobody else can. So he's their boy, but they also can treat him really poorly. So the thing that's really tricky, though, about this is that, you know, you look at these roles, people are not stuck in roles all the time. But, and the other part is that the boys, even if they have conflicts with each other, a lot of boys can really have difficult friendships but also love their friends at the same time. It's not such an extreme thing of, like, I hate my friends and I'm still with them. It's that I really like my friends. They're my family, but there's part of them that I really don't like, but I don't know what to do about it. And that's the thing that I tried to talk to boys about.
Do the masterminds just have it all figured out? They've got it made, or is that just a myth?
Oh, they think they do, right? I mean, you know, at some point...
I know those people from school.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, a lot of men... I actually had a conversation with a guy yesterday who said this to me, that he read Masterminds. And what's really rewarding for me is a lot of men have said to me that they've read Masterminds and they can start relating it to their own boyhood and what's going on now in their lives, which I love that they're thinking about that kind of stuff. But, you know, for masterminds, I think that as they, especially in these throes sometimes of adolescence where you can, you know, you sort of have this way of coming across as being much more arrogant than maybe you are, truly, and that it's a show, right? For some masterminds, it's a show, but some are really invested in that and really do believe that they're better than other people and do believe that they have the right to entertain themselves by humiliating other people. And, I mean, unfortunately, that's been my experience working in schools for a long time, is that there's always one or two guys like that. And they can cause a tremendous amount of trouble and havoc amongst, you know, with other people. So sometimes you grow out of it. Hopefully you do, because you realize that your relationships are actually never strong. If you have that rule, you can never actually depend on your friendships being really, really strong, because they're just, you know, people just aren't going to want to deal with you. They'll agree with you because they just don't want to be bothered. And as you get older, that gets worse. It gets harder. But, you know, so some of these things are, like, really positive in some ways, positive leadership characteristics. That's the tricky thing. It's just that what happens is you get to a place as a mastermind where all of these charismatic sort of leadership qualities also get you to a point where you will not allow other people to disagree with you, or you think you can speak for other people, or at worst, you feel like you get to do whatever you want to other people without consequence.
Do schools know any of this, or are they just trying to get by?
Do schools know any of this? I think that a lot of educators know a little bit about it. I think some are really gifted at this, but truly, how difficult is it in the moment when you're trying to teach, you know, 25 kids? The problem is, and this is why I do so much work with teachers and do professional development, is that these dynamics really impact the classroom and how you are perceived as an ethical authority figure. Because if you don't understand these dynamics, you're going to get manipulated by socially powerful kids very easily. You know, the easiest way that I can say it is, as an educator, you pretty much always see the second hit. You don't ever see the first hit. You don't see the thing that initiated the problem, somebody who said something, and then the kid who maybe has less social skills or is more reactive, he lashes out. Well, as a teacher, when you see the second hit and you discipline or get angry at the second child, what you're doing is reinforcing the power of the first kid who started it. That's why it's really important to know these dynamics. And so I'm extraordinarily busy talking to teachers about these issues and how they can manage themselves better. And this is way beyond, you know, when we think about, like, what do we need to be focused on? Well, social competency is really important for both teachers and kids, so that when they're in schools, if they can be competent about that kind of stuff, then they can focus on the things that we all want them to be able to focus on, which is, you know, core curricular stuff. But we also need to have critical thinkers. And we can't have critical thinkers if we literally do not allow them to think through what are the social dynamics around them.
Still to come, our conversation with Rosalind Wiseman about her book Masterminds and Wingmen continues with a look at landmines that parents should really, really avoid. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1260. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Rosalind Wiseman, an internationally recognized best-selling author and educator who has written books and articles about education, self-esteem, and bullying. We're talking about her new book on boys called Masterminds and Wingmen. And I asked about tips throughout the book that she labels landmines to avoid.
Well, in any parenting book I do, I want parents to be mindful of our own behavior that pushes boys away, or in this case, and pushes girls away in the Queen Bees and Wannabes book. And so one of the things that's one of the biggest landmines that the boys talk to me a lot about was that we as parents we ask them way too many questions, especially when we see them at the end of the day. And I think that one of the problems is that experts like me, and including myself, have been saying when you get your kid into a car, you should ask them all these questions. And the boys said to me, yeah, but we're trapped. We don't like that. Like, what are you talking about? The boys said to me at one point, can you just please have parents realize what it would be like if I was waiting for them at the end of a long work day, and I was waiting for them and asking them all these questions about, you know, have you answered all of your emails? Did you handle that horrible problem at work? Like, how did you handle that person who sabotages you at work? Do you want to talk about it? Let's talk about it. Like, let's have this very in-depth conversation. Why won't you talk to that person? What's wrong? I mean, the kids were like, this is so stressful. And then they get mad at me if I just say it's fine, it's good. I really want parents to realize that it's a landmine to come across as interrogating your children, as well-intentioned as you may be, that it comes across as being an interrogation. And so if you see your kid at the end of the day and you just have a few moments of saying, hey, what's up? Like, just have a moment of reconnection. And then later in the evening, you can say, you know, is there anything that's going on that's interesting to you or that I need to know about or you think is important, so that you're checking in with them in a way that they can deal with.
Obviously, you dealt with all sorts of boys in this. Is there any difference along racial lines?
Sure. I think that the boys and I talked a lot about what racism, for example, looks like in boy world and how they respond to it. And I think one of the most important things in answer to your question is that I believe that parents are woefully in denial about the racism that boys are experiencing, observing, experiencing. I am astounded. I was absolutely astounded by white boys saying to me, well, my parents tell me that racism is bad and everyone's equal. And that's it. That's what white parents were saying, like through the boys. That's what I heard over and over again. And there was no time spent on the complexities of these issues or what to do when you're in a situation where a friend says a racist joke or a racist comment or a sexist comment. We're talking in platitudes to boys and sound bites, and it's just absolutely inadequate for the complexities of their lives. So that's one of the things that I found really striking. And I found it really striking across sort of the board, which is I know that boys tease each other a lot. And, you know, I have friends of different races and religions, and we tease each other about the differences, you know, between us. But it's always from a place of sort of love and of knowledge and of also understanding that there are lines you don't cross. And if you do, if by any chance, you apologize immediately, that it's a connection of warmth, right, of knowing somebody well enough. But that's not what the boys, you know, are always doing. What they're doing is sometimes really using race against each other and then saying, I'm just joking. And so, the boy who's targeted can never say anything about it. And I just think it's extraordinarily important for parents to have actually complex, nuanced conversations about race. And they might not know how to do it themselves. So we've got to educate ourselves in order to be able to talk to our boys.
One more, and I don't even know if you have an answer to this, but does single gender education make a difference?
I do have a lot of thoughts about that because I work with a lot of single-sex schools. I think that for certain children, it can be amazing to go to a single-sex school. I think that all girls' schools have done, you know, for generations, have done for like the last 30 years, have done an amazing job, many of them, to really be on the forefront of, for example, brain development in young people and understanding girls and learning and what's best for them. Understanding that girls actually are in a spectrum, they're not all exactly the same, just like boys are not all exactly the same. And nobody, even if you're a boy or a girl, I don't know anybody that likes to sit in a chair for 8 or 10 hours a day being lectured at as their favorite way to be taught about anything. So that's not just about boys. Girls like to have interaction as well. They might behave better, so we think they like it more, but they don't like it anymore, you know, sitting in a chair all day. But I think that for some kids, single-sex education can be an amazing thing. And for some schools that have really embraced it as a way to support a whole child, that's an amazing kind of school to go to. But, you know, at the same time, really depending on the leadership of the school, single-sex or not, you know, it's all about the leaders of the school. And if they are about pleasing the people that have the most power in front of them, then that's not a good school and a safe school for your child to go to.
Rosalind Wiseman is an internationally recognized best-selling author and educator. Her latest book is called Masterminds and Wingmen. It's now out in paperback from Harmony. Do you have good self-control? Is that even a thing we can measure? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. If you find that you're more likely to treat yourself to an indulgent snack after an exceptionally long day, you're not alone. Michael Inslicht, associate professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, reveals how fatigue can undermine our self-control.
Research on the science of self-control has exploded in the past decade. And although studied in many lights, one idea has received more attention than most, the idea that self-control is a limited resource. This idea is intuitive. Just like your car consumes fuel to get from one point to another until there is no more fuel and no more driving, the argument goes that you consume some brain fuel to restrain your behaviors throughout the day until you reach a point where this fuel is used up and you are left without the ability to control yourself any further. This sort of model supposedly explains why people tend to grab bags of chips when they feel mentally exhausted. This idea may sound right, but it is dead wrong. While it is true that people tend to become couch potatoes when they are fatigued, it is not that people cannot control themselves when tired, it is that they choose not to control themselves. Research suggests that what changes when people are tired is the level and quality of their motivation. When people are fatigued, they experience a change in motivational priorities, such that they are less willing to work for the things they feel obliged to do, and more willing to work for the things they like to do. The silver lining here is that people may be able to increase their flagging levels of self-control by finding pleasure in the sometimes onerous, yet necessary activities of life. At best, the idea that self-control is limited is wrong. At worst, it is actually dangerous. The more we hear about this incorrect view, the less motivated we'll be to exert effort when we sense that we're tired. Time to retire this flawed idea.
That was Michael Inslicht of the University of Toronto.
You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.